Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Good evening and welcome to the Birch Aquarium at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at UC San Diego. I am Nigella Hilgarth and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium at Scripps. And it's my very great pleasure this evening to introduce tonight's speaker, Dr. Neil Driscoll. Neil Driscoll is a professor here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, UC San Diego. He's a professor of geology, and he received his BS in science from the University of New Hampshire in Durham. And I'll gloss over quickly the part where he worked at Woods Hole as a research assistant. And then he was awarded a Master of Science at the Graduate School of Oceanography at the University of Rhode Island. And his PhD was from Columbia University in 1992. And he then went to Woods Hole. I can't leave it out. He was there for 5 years and was very distinguished at his time there, won many awards and wrote many papers. And so eventually Scripps understood the error of their ways in not having him here in La Jolla. And so he came as an associate professor in 2000, actually. And then he was promoted to a full professor in 2002. And I think of all the awards he's had, probably the most exciting to him, at least to many of us, is that he won Outstanding Award in Undergraduate Teaching, which we value very highly here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, in 2003. And he really spends most of his time trying to understand the evolution of landscapes and seascapes. And he does that by examining the sediment record and trying to understand the processes that shape the Earth by looking at that record. And I was talking to Neil earlier this evening, and he said to me that what he really likes doing most in the whole world is being on a ship, being on the ocean. And in fact, he spends several months a year at sea, and I see that is something that must be wonderfully exciting, to actually acquire images of the seafloor and the subsurface layers to actually understand the processes that shape the Earth. And so I want you all to welcome Neil Driscoll tonight and his talk entitled Sea Level and Climate History of the Chukchi Sea, Gateway to the Arctic.
Nigella, thank you for your kind words. I'm going to talk to you about the Arctic today and the Arctic Ocean. In this perspective, we're looking from the Bering Sea north through the Bering Strait into the Chukchi Sea. And this is an important gateway. When sea level is low, water from the Pacific Ocean flows into the Arctic. Now, excuse me, when sea level is low, water doesn't flow into the Arctic. That was just a test to see if you were listening. So here, when sea level exposes this area, there's no communication between the northern Pacific and the Arctic. And as I'm going to show you today, when sea level rises, water flows into the Arctic. It's fresher, and it affects the circulation. So we were interested in trying to understand when this happened and some of the climate implications. So before I go on, I'd like to acknowledge my other researchers involved in this research, Lloyd Kegwin and Julie Brigham Drett. We worked together on this project, and it was supported by the National Science Foundation, the Polar Arctic Program. Okay. So here, I'd also like to point out, this is Jenna Hill. She is a graduate student here. She's now a postdoc at Coastal Carolina. Another graduate student that's still here is Liz Johnstone. And I'd like to tell you that this is the strength of Scripps. We have the number one graduate program in oceanography in the country. Okay? This is our stock. We're training the stewards of tomorrow here right now. Okay? And so this is a really great thing. So our students do a lot of the research, and then we give the talks and take the accolades. So here, the motivation was twofold. It was first to understand the sea level rise and climate history here of this region called Beringia, the wide shelf between Alaska and Russia here. We know that about 21,000 years ago, sea level was about 125 meters lower than today. We know that today where sea level is pretty well, and we can look at how it's rising still due to thermal expansion, about 2 millimeters per year. But we don't know how it flooded this area. And the sill, the area that precludes water from moving from the Pacific into the Arctic, is about 50 meters below sea level today. So we wanted to know when the first waters flowed into the Arctic. And secondly, we wanted to know how the climate changed from a maritime climate, that it would be when you had water surrounding the landmass, versus a more terrestrial-dominated climate when the water was further away during these sea level low stands. We know in the past, so here let me just walk you through some of the history of what we're trying to accomplish here. On the right here, you'll see the scale in meters. This here is years before present, going back some 400,000 years. And this is the stable oxygen isotopes, O18. We know that sea level has fluctuated about 125 meters through glacial to, or interglacial to glacial cycles. So here, what we see is the sea level's sawtooth. It falls slowly and rises rapidly. Falls slowly, rises rapidly. So here, the last glacial maximum was right here at about 20,000 years ago, and this was the last interglacial, and that was the current sea level, this dotted line. The sill that separates the Pacific Ocean from the Arctic Ocean is at about 50 meters, and I've delineated it here by this black line. So we're very interested in what happened from about 21,000 years ago to present, and when did sea level actually rise above this sill? Okay. So here's some data from some of the cliffs here north of the Seward Peninsula in Alaska, and it shows that we have storm beaches that are about 10 to 12 meters above present-day sea level. So this last interglacial high stand of sea level in some places appears that it's higher than the present sea level today. There's also assemblages in the cliffs that lead us to believe that maybe the sea ice was much further north then than it is today. So here, I want you to understand that there's natural variability in sea level cycles. There's natural variability where the ice is. Okay? It's very difficult to separate out the natural variability and the anthropogenic causes. Okay? So here, what we're trying to understand is what's natural variability and what's man-caused or anthropogenic. Okay? So here, I just want to give you some idea that in addition to the sea level rising and falling through these glacial cycles, like constantly, 125,000 years, up and down, we also had massive temperature changes. And here, I'm showing you data for the last 16,000 years. On the bottom here is the percent of polar foraminifera of the total percent of foraminifera. And on the top is the air temperature over Greenland. And like what Jeff Severinghouse does, they can take atmospheres that are trapped in the ice and locked in from past times, and they can read the stable isotopes and they can infer temperature. So here, if you look at the air temperature over Greenland, you'll notice that it dropped on the order of about 10 to 12 degrees, shown here in this black line. Now look at the foraminifera. Here, there's hardly any polar foraminifera. And when you get really cold, the assemblage is dominated by polar foraminifera. So here you can see the impact of the climatic change on the fauna here and the foraminifera changing. Okay. Some of the researchers involved in this project were asking questions, well, when did the Bering Sea flood? There's lots of explanations for this time of Earth history called the Younger Dryas, from this flower here that are these Arctic flowers, high mountain flowers, that became more prevalent in Europe during this time frame because of the colder temperatures. So people were asking questions, what actually caused this great change in temperature? Let me remind you that in the medieval warm period, in the Little Ice Age, we're only talking about maybe half to 1 degree temperature variation. If we underwent a temperature variation like this today, it would be very dramatic, okay? So here, we want to try to understand what causes these temperature variations on Earth in the past so we can better understand the response functions of the Earth and the feedback to change, to rapid climate change. This work is from one of the co-PIs in this project, Lloyd Kegwin, and he published this rapid temperature change and response of the foraminifera. So here, when sea level's high, about a spherodrop, 10 to the 6 cubic meters per second. Think of a Qualcomm stadium moving through the Bering Strait every second is about the water mass that's flowing today into the Arctic Ocean. There's a number, the transpolar current is fed by the Kara, Laptev, East Siberian seas, and this current exits the Arctic. We also have the North Atlantic current moving into the Arctic that's warm, surface waters, and we have the Beaufort Gyre. So here, what we wanted to understand is how this fresh water from the Pacific, when it happened, and how it might impact climate. Harold Sverdrup was a director here in 1936 to 48. And he spent 8 months alone with the Chukchi during the Maud expedition. So he spent 8 months up there in the Arctic. And he learned the language and he wrote a wonderful book. And I was thinking, I wonder if Tony knows this is part of the job description for being director. So here, today, as I told you about one Sverdrup of flow goes from the Pacific into the Arctic Ocean. And this is 10 to the 6 cubic meters per second. This is a lot of water. The Pacific is fresher going into the Arctic. Okay? So you're probably wondering, how does one make these curves? How do you make a sea level curve? Well, first, this is the Healy offshore. It's about 400 feet. It's a Coast Guard icebreaker. 53 Coast Guard crewmen run the ship, and there's like 30 scientists that get aboard. And I've sailed on probably 50 cruises in my career. And this is the first time I arrived in Nome. And I said, why isn't the ship tied to a dock? And they said, well, you have to go out by boat. I said, by boat? I said, isn't there a dock anywhere nearby? And in Nome, there's no dock that can have this ship come next to it because she draws about 29 feet. Okay? So what we do is here, your students go into the Nugget Inn. You put on a survival suit and get in this little Zodiac and go out to the ship. They show up later. So here, we went from Nome to Barrow on the Healy, and what our goal was is to map the seafloor, to map the channels that were developed when the sea level was lower. And as these channels fill with estuarine deposits and beach deposits, we can go and find them, and we can image them, and then we can core them. If you go down to Torrey Pines Beach, you can see sequences like the Ardath shales. Okay, these are old estuarine deposits capped by the Torrey beach zones. So we're going to go and look at these deposits that are beneath the seafloor that record sea level rising across this exposed shelf. And we're going to try to date them. Okay? And in so doing, we can actually build a sea level curve and we can understand how the ocean crossed and covered the shelf in this region. Okay? So we headed out of Nome, and my graduate students said, we're going to go out for a minute and take some sunset pictures. Well, they did. These are the Diomedes, little and large. Well, they didn't realize that the sun doesn't ever set. So they stayed out there, and they stayed out there, and they stayed out there. Okay? I tried to explain this to them, but so here, let me emphasize. So we're trying to locate and define these channels. These are channels that I worked on when I was back at that other place Nigella talked about. And we mapped these channels, and we looked at the channel fill, and these channels are related to glacial lakes draining out down the Hudson River and traversing the shelf here off New York. So we want to find these channels up in the Chukchi. We want to core the channels that record Earth history. And by knowing where the sample's from and what depth, then and dating it, we can reconstruct a sea level curve. Okay, so that this is our goal. So here, we use a geophysical system that allows us to image beneath the sediment. It's called a CHIRP. You can start to see the ice forming on this as you pull it out of the water up in the Arctic. You know this is me because I'm wearing shorts. Tony tonight said, Neil, I'm really happy to see you dressed up. I did. it's really cold up there. The crew members made a bet. They had a pool when I'd put long pants on. I don't have any. Even the water looks cold. Look at how cold that water looks. The chirp wasn't even happy, okay? All right, so the water's cold, the air's cold, and this is the system, and I'm going to show you now a little image of how this works. And I'm going to turn on the sound, so if you can hear this. What happens is it emits a signal from these transducers. Here we go. Now, did you hear that? It's like a 300-pound cricket. Okay. We built this system, and so it transmits sound that then hits the seafloor and the underlying layers. These layers have velocity and density differences. The differences cause some sound to be reflected back to the surface, and we record it here in these receivers. The signal is very complicated and long. It's about 50 milliseconds in time. So this would have very poor resolution power. What we do is we process it with match filtering. We can collapse the signal down to a spike. We can get 10 centimeter resolution of the layers beneath the Earth that record Earth history. So now we're able to make images beneath the seafloor that are like road cuts that you drive by. And these layers record the change in Earth history. Okay? This is what we want to use to find the channels. So when we're out at sea, we make these profiles. So here, let me help you out. This here, this dark line is the seafloor. This here, these are scales. These are 5 meters apart and 200 meters apart in this direction. You can see the surface, the layers dipping. You can see this geometry. So while we're out there, we're trying to image these channels that were cut when the shelf was exposed and rivers coursed across the exposed shelves. We want to core the sediment that's in these channels, because as the sea level rises, the channels are filled in systematically. So at first we see fluvial deposits overlain by estuarine deposits, and then shallow marine, and then deeper marine. And we can use these as time capsules to reconstruct how the sea level filled in these channels and started to cover the Bering Straits and the Chukchi Shelf. My students then bring these home and process them, and they're all really good with colors. They know how to use colored pencils. We interpret these, and we build a story based on geometry and acoustic reflection. I'd like you to notice that this here is 7.5 meters, and that's 500 meters. So there's huge vertical exaggeration. But you can clearly see this channel that's cut and these dipping layers that are truncated. This used to be a fluvial river going across the Chukchi Sea, and this was formed sometime before 20,000 years ago. Okay? As sea level flooded across this, we started filling the channel in till the sea level flooded across and deposited these marine deposits that you see in the blue and purple. So we read these. We're able to interpret based on the geometry and make predictions about the facies. And so we then can go and say whether it's going to be estuarine or beach or river deposits, and we can go and core them. So here we build up a survey of regional geophysics, remote sensing, and we define where the channels go. We define where we think the deposits are. We argue about it a lot. This is Lloyd Kegwin, the other chief scientist. My hat's spun around because I've been looking at data for hours, and I sleep very little on these ships. I was up for about 3 days at this point. And you're looking at the channels, and you're picking sites to core. Now here comes the tricky part. So here, there's a sequence to how we core these units. We first use a gravity core that's shown here. It's 10 feet in length, and it has about a 500-pound core head. It's attached to the wire. We lower it down about 50 meters per minute, and we drive it into the bottom of the ocean. When we pull it out, these core fingers, and I'm going to show you pictures, close down and trap the sediment because there's lots of suction. If you've ever put your foot into a swamp, you usually lose your sneaker as you pull it out. Okay, so the suction is high on these cores as you pull it out, and you have to have something that traps the sediment and keeps it in the core. We do these first because they're short, and we can drive it in and we can test if we're right. Remote sensing and predicting what's down there and what comes back is very humbling. Okay. Second, we then use a piston core, and we rig these up to 40 feet. These don't work very well if there's coarse sediment, sands, and silts. So that's why we use the gravity core first to test if our ideas are right. We put this down. This has about a 2,000 to 3,000 pound core head. Let me just show you how this system works. So here, there's a trigger core that hits and releases the large core, and it free falls into the sediment. When it free falls, the piston stops right at the seafloor, and the barrel drops over it. This creates suction. It allows the sediment to go in easier into the barrel. Okay? The core catcher here with the fingers actually let the sediment in and then fold down and trap that sediment so we can bring it back to the surface. Okay? So here, the trigger arm hits the seafloor first. It releases the piston core that then free falls. So we're letting 2,000 to 3,000 pounds just drop. Okay? And if it's sandy, it's bent and no one's very happy. Okay? These coring devices are large pieces of equipment. This is a vibra core. This is 30 feet, 10 meters high. And here, this was built by Coastal Carolina. Paul Gaze was another scientist involved in this project. And the vibra core, this is the core head that vibrates. And it rides on these two poles. So when we put it in the water, this will be at the top. And then it has a long core and it vibrates it down into the sand. So this is how we recover sand on shelves. Okay? So this sand is really hard to core with a gravity core. You bend piston cores. Vibra cores are the way to go. Okay? But they're big. This weighs 20,000 pounds. These pads allow it to sit on the seafloor. You lower it over the side and sit it on the seafloor, and then you turn on the electronics. This big vibrating head vibrates the barrel down into the sediment, and then you pull it out, and the rest of the core catcher and devices are similar to the other cores. Really good in coarse sediment and gravel. So now let me show you some of the data that we recovered. So I'm going to start from the south in Hope Valley, and I'm going to show you here some of the data from Giant Piston Core 02. I'm going to show you some of the data from Giant Piston Core 10, and then we'll move out to the outer shelf. So here, to orient you, this is the core now projected onto the CHIRP seismic data, and you can see this very bright, high amplitude, dark reflector here. This records when sea level flooded across the Chukchi Sea. Above it is marine, unit 6. Below it is terrigenous or subaerial deposits. And you can see that here in this plot. So what this plot is showing you is grain size, and 63 microns, which separates silt from sand, is right about here. The basal part of this core that's shown by green recovered predominantly sands. These coarse sands that then were overlain by marine muds. Okay? We also notice a pronounced difference in the mineralogy in the copper, nickel, zinc, sulfate above this transgressive surface. So this surface right here records when the sea level moved across this area. So what we can do is here on the top panel, we're showing mean grain size, again, from 0 to 200 microns. 63 microns is the silt sand break. And what I'd like you to look at first is these closed squares. So below about 800 centimeters, the core was the sandy material, and then it's very fine silt above it. So there's a pronounced change in the lithology. Beneath this transgressive surface is a coarse, blocky sand. Above it is a silt. Now here in the open square shows the abundance of a foraminifera, benthic foraminifera, Alphidium. Notice the peak here in abundance that correlates very well with the change from sand to silt. We've dated this using radiocarbon dating, and we get an age of about 10,900 years in radiocarbon years. And when you convert that to calendar years, it's about 12,000 years ago. We also notice, now I'd like you to focus on this bottom panel. Here on this scale is the stable isotope Del-O-18 for the Alphidium, and here is the stable isotope Del-C-13. And what I'd just like to bring to your attention is you notice that here the oxygen is very minus here in the sands, and then goes and becomes more positive. We interpret this change as going from brackish, freshwater, estuarine, to marine conditions here. And look, it happens really fast. Likewise, when you look at the stable isotopes of carbon, they also change from here being more light to less light as we go across this boundary. And we interpret this as recording the change from estuarine, more freshwater conditions, to more open marine. Now let's look at JPC-10. I've projected it here onto the profile. The blue is marine layers as well as the purple. So here we cored into non-marine, this CM, this constructural mound, that's this well-sorted sand. So here, the transgressive surface that records flooding this part of the shelf is shown right here. Again, notice the abrupt change. Blocky sands beneath, a coarse lag, and then you go into fine-grained sediments. Here are the calendar years based on articulated shells that we found in the core, 10,200. Notice that right here near the top of the core, it's still about 8,500 years old. Okay, so there's not much modern sediment here if we've captured all the sediment. There might be some blow-off. We might have missed the upper meter or so, but we see this in every core. So we've built confidence that their sedimentation rate to this part of the margin drops dramatically about 7,000 to 8,000 years ago, and I'll come back to this. Okay, so here, the age here, JPC-10, is slightly younger. Okay, and the reason it's slightly younger is, see this marine material here? We miss this. So when you core, you want to get the oldest marine material over the youngest non-marine. And we missed, okay? So a section of time is missing in this chronology, and that's why the two ages are different. So here, we fought very hard for these two sites. So this is the sea level curve going from about 22,000 years ago to present. Here's the sill depth at the Bering Sea, the depth that separates the Pacific Ocean from the Arctic Ocean as you flood. So anything that rises above this will communicate with the Arctic, and before it won't. Here is the Hope Valley core that I showed you, JPCO2. This here is a maximum age, which is about 12,000 years ago. So we believe the sill was flooded here at about 12,000 years ago. JPC-10 is an age that we believe is slightly offset and is a minimum, because it didn't record the marine sediments beneath the surface of transgression. The important thing is that we now believe the flooding is about 1,000 years earlier than previously proposed by Elias and group that looked at terrigenous organic material and cores and dated it. This has a lot to do with when this land bridge was finally covered, when the climate actually went from more of a terrestrial climate to a maritime-dominated climate. So all of these changes we now believe are about 1,000 years earlier. Now you're sitting there going, wow, he's told us all of this for 2 points. Well, I just want to show you first that this is sea level at 55 meters, so we're just not communicating yet from the North Pacific into the Arctic Ocean. Okay? Oh, things happen at sea. This here is Alex, a graduate student from UW, University of Washington. He was always up at the bridge, and he was asking the captain of the ship if there was something he could do. And one day I said to the captain, I said, I've got an idea, let's do a radar calibration. So the captain was sitting up there, and Alex was right next to him, and Alex said, is there anything I can do? And the captain said, well, you know, the radar's on the, it's glitchy today, and we need to do a test. Alex went right for it. So we got him here in the fire retardant flight suits, and we told him that when we turned the radar on, he had to be grounded to metal because it built up so much static electricity on the suit that he would just fry. It gets better. We told Alex he can't look at the radar. The bridge, everyone was on the bridge. The flash cubes were going off. It looked like the Super Bowl. And Alex got it. We have more cores from offshore that also document this flooding surface or this change from being coarse-grained sands to open marine. These are on the outer shelf. So what we do is we try to build up a consistent story of when sea level moved across the Chukchi and Bering Shelf. So here, a couple of other things I want to point out before I tell you about other data points for the sea level curve. Here is a profile across this channel, and I'd like you to look at the uninterpreted. You can see this channel is cut, and we have geometry of cut and fill. But over here, the pattern looks very different. It's very continuous. It's high amplitude. And these channels appear to be cut at about 14,000 and 12,000 years before present. This is a time when the sea level's rising. So I just told you that channels are cut when sea level falls and exposes the shelf. Channels can also be cut when you lower the sediment supply in the draining water. So if you change the sediment to water ratio in rivers, they can also downcut. Or if you change the amount of water in the river channels. Okay, so two ways you can downcut channels without changing base level is to lower the sediment that's suspended in the water or increase the amount of water. Okay. So here, another thing I pointed out earlier, that most of the cores that we collect show there's very little sedimentation from about 7,000 or 8,000 years to present, and the sedimentation rate goes up higher. We would propose that this is also consistent with increased discharge on the Chukchi Shelf coming maybe from glacial meltwater and rivers that are transporting sediment out during the rise. So as sea level's rising, the glaciers are melting, there's an interplay. We can make these diagrams where we can map out the three-dimensional geometry of these channels. We can actually look where the targets go and trace them across the Chukchi Sea, and we can identify coring sites. Now here, on the Healy, sea ice equals shore leave. Okay? The hold was full of beer, all right? And it's locked up behind this wire gate. And the workout room was right near the wire gate. You'd look over, there's beer. But you can't drink beer on the ship. You have to find ice. And what they do is everyone gets off onto the ice and they lower the beer off onto the ice, and it's a great time. So they're always looking for ice. Okay? That's like the biggest piece of ice we saw. Okay? I'm not going to be drinking on that. Sea ice also helps these large icebreakers hold position. What they do is they ram up onto the ice. You have a lead of open ice behind you, and it can hold position very well by pushing itself against the ice, and you can core. Imagine sticking something 40 feet into the sediment, and then you're not right over it, you're over here, and trying to pull it out. It doesn't work very well. Okay? So the sea ice helps you core and hold position. The sea ice is really terrible for geophysical equipment. You can imagine that you have to break a lead through the sea ice and then turn around and collect your data. So the lack of sea ice allowed us to get really unprecedented geophysical data, not much core data. Okay. As a result, I lost two piston core systems. They belonged to Woods Hole. I set their program back years. Okay. All right. I also lost Coastal Carolina's VibraCore system. Okay. I wasn't very popular. Okay. So at first, here's a straight one. Here's one that happens when you don't hold position and you get off position and you bend the pipe because you're pulling this thing at an angle when it's still stuck in the bottom. Not good. The next core after this, it was gone. Okay. All right. Sea ice. The polar bears, we were about 200 miles from shore. And this polar bear, we were very attractive to this polar bear. Okay, as you can see, the polar bear is smelling us. All my students thought the polar bear was very cute. I told them polar bears love oranges. So they all ran down to the galley and got oranges. And they threw oranges at the polar bear. Hundreds of oranges. The steward's going, "What are you doing? We don't have any more oranges." My students are looking at me saying, "He's not eating the oranges." I said, "Well, you got to cut them open so we can smell them." So they got their knives out and they cut them open and throw some more. So around this polar bear was a sea of oranges. And I didn't say a word for 2 weeks till we came into Barrow. And I looked at Liz Johnstone and I said, do you think a polar bear's ever seen an orange? Okay. So if you have kids, you watch Deadliest Catch. This is the rescue helicopter out of Barrow. We convinced them to fly us a new piston core. This is a 3,000-pound core head and barrels that they agreed to fly out from Barrow. I was just hoping they didn't drop it when they got over the ship. Okay. So we were able to keep coring. This is what the VibraCore looks like. This is my side scan instrument, so we tried to go get it. And we imaged the VibraCore. You can actually see the wires and equipment on the seafloor. So we tried to go grapple for it. Okay, so we used the vessel and we built a grappling hook out of half-inch steel to try to get it. We didn't. Okay. This is make-believe. This is Neil Gilstra, the engineer, but here's the grappling hook. We hooked it. We didn't go anywhere. It was like trying to pull up a giant anchor. Okay, so we decided to leave it there. Okay. So here, we have collected a lot of other samples. This here is a paper that's now accepted in marine geology that Jenna and I have just finished up. And it shows some of the other constraints from the cores around that we believe shows very well that the incised channel here, I3, we believe was cut about 14,000 years ago as the glaciers were melting. We believe that there was more ice in the Arctic than previously proposed. As the ice was melting, the discharge increased and cut these channels as sea level was rising. We believe that the sea level flooded across the sill at about 12,000 years ago, as I told you before. Here's JPCO2. But we believe the other channel cut and iceberg scours that we see happened at about 12 to 13,000 years ago. So we're trying to build this history of the Chukchi Shelf. But coring, when you have a giant icebreaker that's there at 5 stories high and it's blowing, is very hard to keep on station when there's no ice. So we fell prey with the coring equipment, but we benefited largely with the geophysics. We're submitting a drilling proposal at the end of this month to go back because the geophysical remote sensing data tells us right where to drill. So hopefully when I give another one of these prospective lectures, we'll have filled in more of this curve of the sea level history that the Chukchi Sea, how it flooded into the shallower depths. The helicopter pilots have to keep training every day, so this is another perk to be on the Coast Guard cutter. You get to go up and fly in the helicopters. So they take off from the back helipad and do training missions, and they allow you to go with them. You also get to see the northern lights, okay? Very spectacular. Curtains just moving across the sky here as it started to get darker in late September of our cruise. Still light on the horizon, but these are spectacular, okay? So I'd like you to take away this message. We've been able to show that we believe that sea level flooded this region about 1,000 years earlier than previously believed based on other radiocarbon dating of organic matter from the Chukchi Shelf. This has implications for the land bridge and when the climate history changed in this area called Beringia. We're still working on trying to understand and put this into models that we can understand how this circulation might impact climate and temperature changes and how certain areas get warmer or colder. We also believe that the channels cut and the high sedimentation rates that we see prior to 8,000 years ago, that we believe that there was much more ice than people had previously proposed. Right now, Alaska is very dry. Their rainfall is about the same as here in San Diego. Okay, so the rivers aren't very large rivers, and these channels offshore are much larger than their counterparts onshore. So we believe that the channels are what we call misfit. So we need another source of water or a way to diminish the sediment. I told you that the sedimentation rates were higher on the shelf then than they are now. So I can't use diminishing sediment in the water to explain this downcutting and erosion. So the easiest way is that we're saying that there's more discharge. Now whether this is melting from an ice sheet or glacial lakes breaching and supplying the water, we're still trying to figure this out. working on the North Range here, north of the Brooks Range, there's very few field camps there, and that's because there's bears. And it's a very difficult environment to work. But we want to use the helicopters off the Healy to fly in and map some of these channels and map some of the onshore geology to complement what we've seen offshore. And in so doing, we'll have this link between the climate history onshore and what we see offshore. And with that, I'd like to thank you for your time and any questions. So the question was, is here the flooding of the Bering Strait, the Bering Sea and the Chukchi Sea, and having communication from the Pacific into the Arctic, was this a very rapid event or was this longer term? And when we look at the sea level rise, I showed you the sea level fall from the last interglacial, which is about 125,000 years ago, took about 100,000 years for the sea level to fall and the ice sheets to build up. It only takes about 10,000 years for the ice sheets to go away and the sea level to rise. So the sea level rise is usually very rapid when we melt the ice sheets, and the building of the ice sheets takes a long period of time, and the sea level falls over a long period. So we think that within a few thousand years, that here we know from other areas like Barbados, the Huon Peninsula, Tahiti, that this part of the curve is very steep, and it appears that it went in pulses, and we call them meltwater pulse 1A and 1B. And this here, we believe that the flooding was occurring somewhere right after meltwater pulse 1A. So we believe in a few thousand years that you flooded from the middle shelf and actually caused communication between the Pacific and the Arctic. So it's pretty rapid. Well, the on the Atlantic side, the sill depth is much deeper. So when you lower sea level, you still have North Atlantic surface water flowing into the Arctic. This area called Beringia, this broad shelf that's under the Bering and Chukchi Sea, is right about, you know, the sill is at 50 meters. So it's susceptible to every sea level cycle. These sea level cycles have been roughly about 120 to 125 meters, and they've happened for like the last 2.7 million years. So the ice builds up, the sea level falls and exposes the shelf, the ice melts and the shelf becomes flooded, and there's a sea level incursion in that region. The Atlantic, the passageway into the Arctic is much deeper and doesn't fall prey to this situation. Oh, the Arctic region doesn't go down, but it goes down globally 125 meters, just like all the other seas. This is a eustatic signal. When we remove from evaporation, we remove the water and store it on land, we see sea level go down in all the oceans about 125 meters. Yes, this is opening and closing of that gateway due to the DC shift. So Bob asked me, seeing I'm now an expert at losing other people's equipment, that is there any insights that I gained from this process that would allow us to recover these cores and not lose the equipment? And the first thing is that the icebreaker doesn't really have a dynamic positioning. What it does is it has a bow thruster and the propeller at the stern. And what they do is they put them in opposite directions, hoping that they hold station. And so when there's no ice, it's five stories high, and it's like having a giant jib out in front of you, more like a spinnaker, and you just blow downwind. And so you move off the core. So even though the seas were very flat, which is usually ideal for coring, we were in shallow water, so that angle's exacerbated. If you're in deeper water, you can then pull at an angle and it's not such a problem. But in shallow water, you move off a little and it's much worse. So the ice worked against us. We got great geophysical data, but not great coring data. So what we're hoping with the drilling vessel that has thrusters and can hold dynamic positioning, that we can actually drill these channels and do a transect down the channels and actually recover all the sequences and build a systematic sea level curve. There is a coring device that Woods Hole's building, and you know it, that hopefully will ride on our ship, the Melville, this long coring device that will allow us to get cores back, potentially back 30 to 40 meters. Okay, and that's just had its sea trials this summer on the Nore, and it looks like they were very successful. Jim Broda contacted me, and they recovered 30-meter cores. So 120 feet, you know, 90 to 120 feet cores that they recovered, and this is spectacular for doing paleoclimate and sea level history. When you see a lot of times when you have a large discharge flow, the channel is usually wider and has less relief. A meandering or full stream flow has a cut bank and a point bar. So when you have a meandering or more continuous flow, you usually see greater relief in the channel. Large discharge braided rivers are usually shallow channels with bars, gravel, and they're intermittent. They're defined by having a lot of variability in flow. So when we look at these breaking or yokel-ups off Iceland, off the East Coast, off here, usually you have coarse material that it shed due to the high flow, and they wane very fast. So you don't develop more meandering, systematic bends and migration of meanders down the stream system. So we can tell, but the problem is when you're imaging, you're connecting lines and you're trying to envision 3D, as I showed you, with sparse line collections. So it sometimes can be difficult to say whether the river meandered between the lines and things like that. So usually you can tell by the facies and the geometry and relief, but not always. Yeah, the question is the terraces. So what are we looking at with the terraces? Are we looking at windward, leeward processes? What are forming some of these terraces that we observe around San Diego and the islands here? Or is that your question? A lot of the terraces, if you walk around, like on upper campus, is a flat terrace. This terrace is the Bay Point Formation. It was formed about 125,000 years ago as the land was uplifted out of sea level. And you can see these lags, these cobble lags, and a perfect place to go see this is up at Torrey Pines. You can see the Ardath, and you can see the estuarine deposits with shells. And then you go up through the Torrey, which erodes different because the cements start being eroded by meteoric water, and then the wind enhances that erosion. And then you have this gravel lag sitting on top of it, above which you see a browner sediment, which is the Bay Point or the Linda Vista. The Linda Vista is more like 2 million years old. But these terraces are when the land is uplifted through sea level. Think of the flattest surface on the earth due to erosion, not deposition now, due to erosion. Rivers cause increased relief, like the Grand Canyon. Rivers cause change from interfluves to the channel. Waves cause a flattening. They erode the highs and they infill the lows. The beach is one of the flattest surfaces created by erosion. So as the land goes up through the sea, it's eroded by the wave base energy and it makes a flat terrace. And the rocks and gravel that are on that terrace are preserved as it comes up. Those are like your cusps and your coarse grain cobbles that are on the beach. And as it comes up out of sea level, it's preserved, and then you have alluvial, fluvial sediments on top. So these terraces are created by an interaction of tectonics uplifting the landscapes and wave base erosion, which I call the wave base razor, that erodes the highs and infills the lows. And as land goes through this zone, I would tell you it makes very flat relief. And the continental shelves that are exposed to this wave base erosion for the last 2.7 million years, where water lowers to 125 meters, then rises, I would tell you the continental shelves in large part are very flat. They have a slope of much less than a degree, is due to some of this wave base erosion, eroding the highs and infilling the lows. Yes, when we were there, there were a lot of polar bears going in and out of the Kwanzaa huts looking to eat people that had consumed tacos. And a polar bear, unlike a brown bear or a grizzly bear, only has one motive: to eat you. And I had a few students. I was the last off the boat, flown off by the helicopter. And I got in the shuttle, and on this dirt road in Barrow, with the dump right there with a big fence, no trees, nothing for miles. Barrow's just this big beach spit. My students were walking down to take pictures of a polar bear eating a dead seal on the beach. Uh-oh. Darwin Award right there. Okay, so I stopped the van and I just said, get in. And they looked at me, I said, no, get in. And they got in and I explained to them if they had been upwind of that polar bear, they would have been like a tube steak. Okay? So when we were there, you had to bang on the door and look out the windows so you didn't run into Mr. and Mrs. Polar Bear right outside your door. And it was frightening, and you stayed in groups, and you always made sure you could outrun somebody in the group. The question is, here with the flow out of the Arctic, Wally Broker coined this phrase called the conveyor belt. It's a thermal haline circulation. What happens as surface water, the Gulf Stream, moves north through areas of high evaporation? The horse latitudes are where we have all the deserts, where we have all the descending air mass. This causes a lot of evaporation. So the water's warm and salty and it moves north. And as it moves north, it bathes Europe, England, and Ireland and keeps them warm, much warmer than areas at the same latitude in Canada. As this water moves north, it cools and it becomes dense and sinks and ventilates the ocean basins. As this does this, it then pulls more water northward. So this is, we don't change the amount of heat that comes to the Earth, we change how we redistribute it from the equatorial regions to the poles. And what circulation out of the Arctic might do, and we believe that glacial meltwater can do this too, is if you have big slugs of fresh water that inject into this thermal haline circulation, it diminishes its ability to get dense and sink and ventilate the deep parts of the ocean. And therefore, you shut it off. One of the hypotheses for this temperature change in the Younger Dryas is related potentially to the shutting off of the conveyor belt. So it's not that the total heat budget or insulation reaching the Earth changed. It's how we redistribute that heat from low latitude regions to higher latitudes. And this is why we were concerned about Pacific water flowing into the Arctic. Because as the Pacific water flows into the Arctic, how does this affect the circulation? You also have the Ob, the Yenisei, and the Lena rivers that supply fresh water off the Russian Kraton east of the Urals into the Arctic Ocean. So this whole mix is very important in how you change redistribution of heat and circulation. Well, that flow can interrupt it. So here, that flows along and it comes out in the Greenland, right east of Greenland there, and it can interrupt if it's very fresh, an iceberg discharge and sea ice, then it can affect and impact and diminish the vigor of this thermal haline circulation. So what does a polar bear eat? Not oranges. Okay. Although, you know, brown bears eat oranges, and I did watch... It needs ice. That's why a polar bear's... It doesn't eat much, so a polar bear can't swim as fast as seals and walruses. So what it does, polar bear's strategy, is that it finds ice and is very patient for seals and walruses to pull themselves out on the ice. And when there's no ice, they get thin. And although there was a special on the Discovery Channel that they showed that some polar bears are starting to adapt and they're starting to live more on land and start eating more. They're not just carnivores, they're starting to eat, becoming herbivores like their cousins. And so hopefully they'll, with climate change, be able to adapt and not go extinct. So this guy looked very hungry. He clawed at the ship and he was awful cute when I was looking down on him from 10 feet. But if he had gotten on board, it would have been really a bad... We would have had to kill the polar bear. Okay? Yes, it rose globally. But here in the Atlantic, flow was continuing because the sill depth was deeper.
Well, I understand, but the average depth has to change. Water is kind of fluid.
That's right. It changes globally. It's a eustatic... The changes, these glacial-interglacial cycles, are global sea level changes. And we see them in Tahiti, Barbados, Huon Peninsula, Papua New Guinea. So we've reconstructed the sea level history from around the world. So it's a eustatic or global curve.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Howard.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.